Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Seriously, guys, if you're getting your kitchen done and you can afford it, get one of these. Get a cooker tap. They are so good. Cooker, Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. Mine does filtered water, filtered sparkling water, as well as 100 degree boiling hot water. I never buy water, never buy filtered water, never buy bottled water. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. On today's Lovejoy Hour, I'm curious about who I should vote for. I know there's not a general election, but it's a good excuse to speak to Matt Ford about politics. Matt Ford is a comedian. He's a satirist. He's an impersonator. He has a podcast called The Political Party, which is excellent. He's on Absolute Radio presenting rock and roll football. He's so many things. I can't list them all. He's a very, very busy man. And he used to be a member of the Labour Party, and he gave it up when Jeremy Corbyn got voted in as leader. So let's find out who he thinks we should be voting for. Let's meet him. This is Matt Ford. Matt, how are you doing?
Really good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good. I was just sort of doing an intro through to your career there, and you're doing so much at the moment, aren't you? What would you say what's the thing you're most known for at the moment, do you think?
Oh, crikey. I think that's really hard, because in a way that's a question for other people. You know, I always think it's really funny when you do something and you think, not necessarily that that's what you're going to be known for. I guess it's more when people come up to you. So I was at Wembley on Sunday for the England-Croatia game, and a few people come up to me. Mostly people had heard me on Quickly Kevin, Josh Widdicombe's football podcast. So you always think, all right. And then other people will recognise you from other things. It just entirely depends. So I don't know. I mean, I guess telly is, people would recognise your face more. So I did, you know, I'm deeply involved in Spitting Image, and did a lot of promotional work around that, and voiced Trump and Boris and Keir Starmer. So I guess in the last couple of years, it would be Spitting Image.
I suppose we should stipulate at this point for people who don't know about you. You're a Nottingham Forest fan, and used to be a member of the Labour Party. So it's just been healthy. Like real past glories, and now just shit.
Yeah, I mean, that's so true. I remember there was one particular night, actually, where that all came to a head. And it was Forest were playing Blackpool in the playoff semi-final. And it must have been in 2010, because it was just after the 2010 general election, when those coalition negotiations were going on. Gordon Brown was still prime minister. But the Tories were looking to form a coalition with the Lib Dems, but it hadn't been confirmed yet. When that game kicked off, Forest was still within a chance of getting the Premier League, and Labour was still in government. By the end of the game, we'd been knocked out of the playoffs, and the Tories had formed a coalition with the Lib Dems. And it was the bleakest car ride back to London after that of my life. I just thought, oh my God, everything's gone.
Were you still a member of the Labour Party then?
I was still a member then. I wasn't working for the party at that point. I left my membership. I cancelled my Labour Party membership, and I haven't been back since, on the day that Jeremy Corbyn became leader. I mean, I was disillusioned under Ed Miliband. Corbyn, for me, was a step too far. And having worked in the Labour Party, I'd seen people like him before, and I knew those people that can appear genteel and harmless, but whose politics is actually pretty extreme. And I had no time for it at all. And for me, they are not Labour values. And maybe that's something we'll come on to. I think there's a kind of, Labour has a weird relationship with its history, which a lot of it is kind of fictionalized. Yeah. So I just thought it was just not just a step into irrelevance and guaranteed defeat, but actually an extreme worldview that turns its back on things like the EU and America and NATO, looks towards people like Putin and Iran. And I just thought these are totally counter to mainstream. I don't want to help this at all. I don't want to fund it even through, you know, my minimal membership subscriptions. I'm certainly not going to vote for it while he's leader. And that for me was the point of departure. And I haven't been back.
What did the Labour Party, what do Labour supporters say? Because you're obviously quite well, you're very well known as a Labour supporter and as someone with profile. What did they say when you said you're leaving the party? What did Labour support? Because he was very popular, Jeremy Corbyn, wasn't he?
He was amongst some people. he wasn't really with the general public. I mean, it depends. Certainly former colleagues of mine, people that I'd worked with, at the same time were horrified by the rise of Corbyn. I mean, they were pretty pissed off by the rise of Ed Miliband. After everything we'd learned in the Blair years about how you win elections where Labour needs to be, to then go on this self-indulgent departure from that, which always guarantees defeat, and history tells you that, I just thought was incredible. And actually, you know what's really odd about Labour is the people who talk about wanting to help the needy most are always the ones who lose elections and therefore can do absolutely nothing for the most vulnerable people in society. The people who claim to be most animated on, you know, in defence of those communities, communities that I come from, do nothing for them because they don't win. So, and quite apart from what they would do if they won and the way they'd run the country and all the rest of it. So people like me who'd worked for the party under Blair and Brown were horrified by the rise of Jeremy Corbyn. The sorts of people who were newcomers to the Labour Party under Corbyn, obviously, weren't very keen on people like me and made that known, which is, you know, absolutely fair in a democracy.
I'd say every time you mention Ed Miliband, there was we were so close to having David Miliband hanging out in the House of Commons, and he seemed to me to be an absolute star of politics. I don't know what you know him better than I do. And then we lost him forever. And he still, every time he starts speaking, you think this guy's sensible, isn't he? He's like one of the adults in the room. What do you think?
Absolutely, I think you've nailed it. And he was by far more impressive than his brother, so he was the most impressive candidate. And I think there's something in that as well. And this is something that Labour people don't really grasp and that Tories periodically forget. If you're putting someone forward as the leader of one of the two major parties in this country, that is a candidate to run the country. By definition, that has to be a really impressive person. People know that to be a headmaster, you have to be impressive. To be a CEO, to run anything, you need skills. And the Labour Party chose Jeremy Corbyn and effectively said, we think this is the most impressive guy in the country. It was beyond idiotic. In fact, and I don't think the Labour Party's come to terms with it, that was an insult, not just to the general public, but to its own supporters, because they're effectively saying, we can take your support for granted. You'll even vote for this idiot. It was a total insult. You have to give people impressive individuals with leadership skills who can deal with not just domestic issues, but are going to represent this country abroad. So David Miliband absolutely fits that bill. His politics are more closely aligned with the general public of this country than his brothers were. And therefore, you know, that moment when the more talented, gifted brother, who, by the way, the Labour Party members wanted, but the trade unions didn't, and that's what it came down to. And there's a whole other thing there about what the Labour Party is and whose interests it should act in and who the controlling interests of the Labour Party should be. That, for me, was a departure point. And, you know, that set the Labour Party down a particular road. And Jeremy Corbyn's leadership couldn't have happened without Ed Miliband. Ed Miliband is the gateway drug. He's that first spliff. And then Corbyn is basically train spotting, mainlining skag.
I think I've got to say at this point, by the way, I've got to tell people my political persuasion, I suppose. I never talk about politics because, you know, I'm on telly and it's just not worth it. I get called lefty lovey all the time and a Tory boy all the time as well. I swing vote, by the way. I swing vote and I don't have any allegiance to any party. It's not like my football team. You know, I'll admit I voted for Tony Blair. That's about as far as I'll go with a lot of the stuff that I'll do. But, you know, that's where I am. So I'm not pro-Labour or pro-Tory. I'm not pro either of them at the moment, if I'm truthful with you, which is why I want to have this conversation with you, because at the end of this, hopefully you'll be able to make me decide where my vote will go in the next general election. But you're just talking about impressive leaders there. I met your leader, Gordon Brown, right, at Downing Street for some sort of showbiz nonsense that Labour Party liked doing in those days. And what was so bizarre about it is Tony Blair wandered in to say hello to us all, this most really charismatic bloke. And look, no disrespect to Gordon Brown, I'm sure he's a great person to have in a cabinet, but that guy was not a leader either. He shook my hand and I thought, oh, mate, what have we got here? But we didn't even elect him.
Well, I think the problem with Gordon Brown was, you're absolutely right, he's absolutely someone you want in the cabinet. And his economic ability really was second to none. And him and Alistair Darling proved that when you had the global financial crash. And thank God he was part of that government. Tony Blair is one of the most charismatic politicians, not just that this country has ever produced, really, that the world has ever seen. He is, you know, we're going through a football tournament at the moment. When you talk about like natural talent, Tony Blair is a naturally gifted communicator and leader.
Can I just stop you there and say Jeff Norcott told me that rather than having a swear box, I need a Blair box for you. Because you love Tony Blair so much.
Well, so... I just think, and it's the thing you said, is, and this is why political parties should be listening to people like you. And you represent millions of people. And the most important voters are those that are going to switch between the two major parties. They're the voters that I think actually both major parties at the last election stopped talking to. But yes, Gordon Brown, I think, actually, by the time he became prime minister, and this is one of the really interesting things about Gordon Brown, was probably in a position where, I don't know whether he'd admit this himself, he'd have been better off being prime minister back in the day. So had Tony Blair not, you know, they not had that deal with each other, then actually Gordon Brown at that point is a really impressive, charismatic, far more comfortable with himself individual. I think the years of the rivalry with Blair wore away. And by the time he became prime minister, in a way, it was that sense of, and you see it in other areas, you certainly see it in sport, someone's time is slightly past them. He still had a big contribution to make, you know, the global financial crash he did. But I think that rivalry with Blair has slightly eaten away at him. So by the time he became prime minister, he didn't do the job he would have done in his prime.
I thought that Tony Blair book, it was a long time ago I read it, but I thought it's a really sad book. It was like, honestly, I was great. I saved the royal family. I got peace in Ireland. I'm the greatest. Everyone hated me and I was fighting my own party. Please like me because I'm really good. It kind of really felt like that when you read it. And I felt, you know, the guy. Did you actually work with him or for him or?
I worked for the party when he was leader. I was never anywhere near Downing Street. Apart from for parties, we'd get invited there for receptions. I would just go there and get absolutely shit-faced. Absolutely, I don't know if you got drunk when you went there, but it was great if you're a member of staff being able to throw parties at number 10. And I went to his leaving do at Chequers.
I've got to say, I was there with a load of comedians and bands and stuff like that.
Oh, man.
And we were all looking at each other going, we were a part of a task force to get kids into entertainment or something. And we're all looking at each other going, we're only here really because we got an invite from Downing Street. And then it was like kind of this really weird thing where at the end it was like, and, you know, what we do. And it just felt like we were all just, honestly, it felt like we were all being bought in to support the Labour Party. And, you know, but it's fine. You know, it was a good idea to get us in there. And it's and they need to appeal to the entertainment industry, don't they, I suppose?
Well, I totally agree. And I would far rather all industries be invited to things like that. And entertainment, and you've seen it during COVID at times, it felt like the Conservatives haven't had the same connection with that industry as the Labour Party in its prime did. And they haven't had the same instincts or that desire to welcome creatives in it, perhaps in the same way. So, I mean, whenever politicians invite celebrities in, I think both sides have to slightly be aware what the deal is.
What do you think of that with the entertainment industry? We're going all over the place here. Well, I imagine this is how this conversation is going to go. But Jeff Norcott obviously has to struggle by going, hey, I vote Conservative and I work in the entertainment industry. You can quite happily go, I work for Labour. And no one is going to bat an eyelid because, you know, that's the entertainment industry. It's quite a strange set of circumstances we're in now, isn't it?
Just a little bit. I mean, obviously, there are Conservatives in comedy and always have been, and there are Conservatives in entertainment and in entertainment commissioning and all sorts of things. I guess it's just about whether people choose to talk about it or not, and that's another thing. I mean, I think, now I was really anti-Corbyn, and my last two or three tours and Edinburgh runs were very anti-Corbyn, to the point where I had people walking out pretty much most days during Edinburgh. And that's never the sort of comedy I've set out to make. You know, I never set out to be an edgelord offending people. And actually, I don't think my comedy was offensive. It was, you know, basic statements of fact that were offending Corbyn supporters. So I guess it's not necessarily true that just being kind of on the left or on the liberal left is without its problems, because, you know, the left itself is a divided place. And for a lot of people, you know, they see me as worse than Jeff. Now, Blairites are the sort of scum of the earth, really, because I think they think, well, at least a Tory's a Tory. You know, you are a Tory, but you're pretending you're not. You know, that's kind of the kind of analysis of what a Blairite is. It's somebody who wants to be a Tory but can't admit it, which, of course, isn't true. So, you know, I think with any politics, I think if you talk openly, it comes back to what you said earlier, it's going to cause you a level of problem with someone. because immediately then you're seen as that first. Oh, you're saying that because you used to work for Labour, or because you're a Blairite, or because you're a Tory. And it kind of, to some extent, removes your individuality. So I fully understand why people don't want to come out.
When you were working for the Labour Party, did you feel real animosity towards Tories, Lib Dems, Greens?
That's a really good question. Because I guess when I became Labour as a kid, it was kind of in reaction to Thatcher. It was push and pull. I found the Labour Party attractive. I didn't find the Tories attractive. So when I first joined the Labour Party, I thought the Conservatives were the enemy. The opponents. I never deeply hated Tories. I was never that sort of guy. I had a fortnight in the Socialist Worker Party when I was 14, and that was probably about as radical as I ever got. It was just absolutely crackers. Just the most aggressive, angry people I'd ever met. I was like, this isn't for me. And partly the reason why when Corbyn came along, I kind of knew what it was all about. But no, I never hated them. I always thought, you know, I really liked Ken Clark growing up. And maybe it's because he was a Forest fan and I grew up in Nottingham, but I always just thought, oh, these things quite... I quite like John Major. I never hated these people. Thatcher was tricky, I think, growing up where I did and in the time I did. By the time I came to work for the Labour Party, I saw the Tories really as opponents to be defeated. It was only in working with the Labour Party I realised that actually Labour staff don't hate the Tories. They hate the Lib Dems. The Lib Dems... And I was like, what? But they're basically like... kind of Labour, and they're like, absolutely not. They're the biggest liars on the planet. And then you go on a by-election, and I worked on the job I did. I was an organiser, so I'd work on elections all over the country, by-elections and local elections. And that is a huge education in all sorts of things, mainly what the public will and won't stand for. And a lot of common themes bind Britain. You know, whether you're in Scotland, Wales, inner city London, wherever, people know bullshit. Straight away, right? So you just like, you don't even try. But it was on these by-elections that you realise, oh my God, the Lib Dems, who publicly, I think Charles Kennedy was leader at the time, who I was a big fan of, were kind of the sweet and nice party. And they were like demons in a by-election. They were like the dirtiest tricks. They pull your posters down, all sorts of genuine, like, you know, like, not black ops, but like, you know, they'd push it a bit. And the Greens, oh my God, again, people think the Greens, oh, they're lovely people. You know, they just eat pulses all day and lentils. And they basically like, they're as close to God as you're going to get in politics. They are the angriest. I remember doing an event in Brighton when I first started kind of doing political interviews. And it was down in Brighton. It must have been the 2010 election. And I interviewed Caroline Lucas. I think it was Nancy Platts who was the Labour candidate, the Tory candidate and the Lib Dem. And it was basically fine. It was down in Brighton. It was a good laugh. The Greens turned up like mob anders. It was like an away day. I thought, what is going on? They just screamed everyone else down. And Caroline Lucas basically didn't sort of really react to it. I was like, you go, these people are really angry. They were screaming at everyone. You still have those moments in any industry, I think, where you go, oh God. No matter how long you've been around, there's still a lot you can learn. I thought, obviously, a lot of Green Party people are very nice. And they're very well-meaning and they live their lives in a good way. But there is that element in that Green politics, and Corbyn was a part of that, that is actually has really aggressive supporters who basically can't be reasoned with.
I suppose they've got the leaders, though, or the MPs, sorry. They've got careers to think about, and they get cash from it. You know, who's the bloke who went out with
Lembit Opik.
Yeah. All right. How did you get that from the guy who went out with the...
Because I thought you were going to go cheeky girl.
Yes, I was. And it's like, he was everywhere. He had a career. And now I have no idea what he does. He's just fallen off the face of the earth. So he might have still have a career, but I don't know what in. So, you know, you lose that, you lose a lot.
Well, you've tapped into something there. And it's not just about the fact that I don't think it's financial, but it's that they... And think about the last few years. Every single major party in this country has had a moment where it really should have controlled its own supporters more. The first one is 2014 in the Scottish independence referendum, where supporters of independence were basically allowed to do what they liked. And Jim Murphy, who was a Labour MP at the time, basically got pelted with eggs, had to suspend campaigning. You know, the sort of thing we saw Nicholas Watt running from the other day in central London when people are screaming at him.
That's the Newsnight reporter or the BBC reporter, yeah.
Yeah. That was going on in Scotland in 2014. We had all this stuff about the MSM And I think 4,000 pro-independence supporters went down to the BBC in Glasgow and like blockaded it. That's not okay. Legitimate protest is okay, but trying to shut down one of the few independent broadcasters we have in the UK and trying to intimidate people. So that was the first one. Then you had the rise of Corbyn and what his supporters were doing, being really aggressive, being really nasty. Luciana Berger had to leave the Labour Party. She was the victim of so much anti-Semitic abuse. Then you had the Brexit referendum in the aftermath, where the Tories basically just let their supporters do what they liked. So if you think of the parties that will or could govern or do govern parts of Britain as an island, both Labour, the Tories and the Scottish National Party have allowed their supporters off the leash. And that has created, those parties should be, mainstream parties should be the gatekeepers of this stuff. They should have the courage to say to their supporters, stop it. We're going to kick you out and be really zero tolerance. But instead they go, oh, well, they're passionate. And well, some of these guys, you know, it's part of a vibrant campaign. There's nothing wrong with it. And sadly, all three of those major parties have really let us down. And they've, that stuff then has effectively infected the mainstream and they're not in control of it anymore.
Have we got the right people in politics at the moment? It strikes me that Jeremy Corbyn didn't really want to be leader of the Labour Party, but he got it. Because I think Jeremy prefers being, you know, in opposition, definitely, and didn't really want to be leader. I think Boris Johnson seemed like he was just playing at it, but he's got it. And even Dominic Cummings today said he doesn't want to be Prime Minister. I think we all knew that. David Cameron a bit felt like it was his stepping stone to where the money's at. They're just like, they've come from the public schools. It's a great thing for their CVs, great part of their family history. That's what it feels like for me. I don't know, I could be so wrong here, but that's a voter who, that's what it feels like. They don't really want the job.
You're absolutely right. And part of the problem is we keep choosing, and this is where the political parties, you know, when people look at the last few years, and actually it doesn't matter what side of the Brexit or the referendum debate or what party you voted for, honestly, it's not about whether voting for or against those things was right or wrong. It's that there has been a collective failure in certainly the two major mainstream parties in the UK, in the Tories and the Labour Party. Their job is to find the most impressive person to lead them, to then be the most impressive person to lead the country. If you're making that decision on secondary things, i.e., well, we want a really left-wing leader of the Labour Party now. Firstly, you're not going to win a general election. So what are you doing involved in a party whose founding principle is winning elections? And with the Tories, I am just shocked at how many of them were prepared to believe Boris Johnson. And I remember during that 2019 leadership election, what was shocking was 2017, sorry, leadership election, was what was, oh no, it was, oh God, forget now. The leadership election was in 2019 and then the election was, wasn't it? I get so confused.
I can't remember, yeah.
But I was talking to Tory MPs who are like, Liberal Remainer types who are like, well, it's got to be Boris. And you're like, what? You know, they were so ready to just... And I think a lot of them have been worn down by Brexit. They've been worn down by those Theresa May years. Just the limbo was killing them. And they were just like, you know what? Let him do Brexit. Let him get on with it. There was a kind of inevitability about Boris with the Tories. They really love him. Elements of them don't, but they, you know, on the whole, what's odd is about Boris is cast a spell over the Tory party, even some of its more liberal corners.
And the voters, the electorate as well. I mean, I had a chat with my friend Al yesterday. It got quite heated because I was saying, oh, well, you know, at a time when we needed a really strong leader, I'm not sure we've got one. You know, it seems to be all over the place. And Dominic Cummings has come out, and whether, I don't know whether you believe him or not, but his party just, the party, I feel sorry for Michael Gove actually, because he's got to keep coming out and lying. That guy's career is, well, you know, Michael, is it, would you go into a car to test your eyesight? I can't believe he had to answer that by going, yeah. He even started laughing. And what was it the other one? He had one the other day as well. Oh, there was no shortage of PPE. What? No, there was shortage of PPE. No, there wasn't. Never. Well, we've got proof here. No. And why didn't you close India? No, no, no. Your facts are wrong. No, they're not. They're here. No, 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 no. But it seems to me with Boris, I was having a bit of an argument with my friend Al, because he went, Boris has done nothing wrong. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but Boris has made literally no mistakes in this. You've got to feel sorry for him. And I went, he's not a four-year-old child for trying his hardest. He's the PM of the country. What I said, what, even when he went to shake hands with people with the virus, that wasn't even a mistake. Even when he decided to do that, like, you know, obviously I give him a, it's unprecedented having a pandemic like this in modern era, but he has made mistakes. But the thing Boris seems to be doing at the moment is just not ever talking about them, refusing to answer them, and it seems to be working.
Yeah, and the thing is, you're absolutely right as well. And what your mate Al, and obviously he's not here to defend himself, but of course Boris has made mistakes, because any leader would have. The best leader in the world would have made mistakes, because as you say, this came out of nowhere. And I think the British public have been pretty fair in their assessment of it all, which is the Tories didn't like invent this virus. They can see the whole world is trying to get to grips with it. They think the vaccine's been handled really well. So there are things that the government has done brilliantly well, and they absolutely deserve the credit for it. But of course they've made mistakes. And this is the problem with Boris, is that refusal to kind of accept reality catches up with you in the end. Because in the end, you can't bullshit people. And what the Tories have had is really an unprecedented 10 years without challenge. And that's led to some very, very bad habits. And they still think they're fighting Jeremy Corbyn. Now, in some regards, they are, because the Labour Party, you know, politics has kind of been paused by COVID. And I think the public are just waiting to see where the Labour Party goes now. And I think people still are waiting to see which direction Keir Starmer's going to go in. I think people think he's sensible, he's calm. I'd probably rather have him as Prime Minister than Boris Johnson. But what about those people sat behind you, and what are they up to? And do they still believe all this nonsense that Corbyn was on about? So that has made the Tories complacent. For now, they can get away with that sort of thing. But the problem is that the pressure grows from other places. Is that if competition doesn't come from the people, you know, any leader of the party will tell you this. When you're stood in the House of Commons, your real enemy isn't in front of you. It's the people sat behind you. It's the people on your own benches. So if a challenge doesn't come in the form of an electable Labour leader, the challenge will come from the Tory benches, because there'll be people like Rishi Sunak, Dominic Raab, and others who think, you know what, let's get rid of this fool. I want to be Prime Minister.
This week's sponsor, Clean Co, creates non-alcoholic alternatives to your favourite four-strength spirits with all the flavour, but a fraction of the calories. Whether you're into gin, rum, vodka, or tequila, Clean Co has a delicious option for you from just 12 calories per serve. Clean Co spirits have over 4,500 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. So head over to clean.co to ditch hangovers and drink clean. Right, so going back to the sort of original germ of this part of the conversation, have we got the wrong people going into politics at the moment? I listened to one of your podcasts the other day, actually, but bizarrely before I contacted you, and it was to do this one, and you with David Owen, and yes. I was listening to that going, oh my god, he sounds like an adult. He seemed very pleasant about the Tories and the Labour Party, which he'd left. He was talking eloquently about politics. He understood what the people wanted. Then I was watching Tony Blair, your hero, talking about with his long hair. And I was thinking, OK, all right, everyone's supposed to hate Tony Blair now. But the guy makes some good points sometimes. Then you listen to Barack Obama talking on a load of chat shows and stuff recently. He sort of understands. And you think, This lot at the moment, maybe it's wrong because we're in the middle of a pandemic. Maybe I've got this wrong, but I don't feel like they're the right politics. They don't feel adult to me. They feel very childish. Let's lie and keep Matt Hancock running around. I mean, just like running around going, no, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. And it's I just kind of think, oh, no, where are we at? Have we got the wrong people?
Well, I agree. What I would say is I don't think it's necessarily that the wrong people are going into politics. Because if you look at the House of Commons, I could name you MPs in every party who are really talented, who are really good, who would be brilliant leaders of their party. So the talent is there. It's that, you know, it comes back to this problem. The last few years, both political parties started choosing people that were wholly unsuited to leadership. The Tory party would never have chosen Boris Johnson to be leader were Jeremy Corbyn not leading the Labour Party, because it would not have made any sense. If David Miliband was leading Labour, Boris would not have got a sniff. And that, knowing that basically you can pick anyone and win, led to a terrible complacency in the Tory party. And Boris Johnson's character is completely ill-suited to leadership at any time. And I think there's something really, there's something not Shakespearean almost, but it's so, you know, the way life unfolds is they basically pick a comedy act, you know, and that, and they would sort of freely admit that's part of the attraction, as would Boris. That's why he behaves like that. And to some extent that makes people feel good. And there's certain value in that. I don't totally talk that down. But you basically choose this renegade character who really isn't up to it. And just as you do that, just as he gets his majority, the biggest crisis since the Second World War grips the globe. And at that point, Labour choose a highly intellectual, credible individual whose former job was the Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, those politics haven't necessarily played out, but it just shows that when you are choosing leaders, you have to be so careful. It's not just about the context now, about, oh, do we want Brexit done and then the Brexiteers can own it. You are always choosing someone that you want in control if a crisis hits. And if you were to ask people deep down, I think even Tory voters, do you want Boris Johnson in charge during a crisis? What's the real answer? You know, and I think Keir Starmer is the sort of person that you would prefer in that situation.
Though what Keir's doing is, because when he was voted as leader of the Labour Party, I thought, oh, this is interesting, because, you know, I could see Jeremy Corbyn was a failure. And I thought, this is really interesting. They put someone more Blairish in. And I thought, okay, this is fascinating now. But all he's done so far is say too little, too late, like constantly too little, too late. And is he showing us a future? Like, I think the thing that Tony Blair did so well, you're going to love this because he's your hero, but he gave us a few. We felt like we were going to be the greatest country in the world. He sort of got the Union Jack back. You've got to remember, sort of Spice Girls wearing the Union Jack. Noel Gallagher had a Union Jack guitar. He got that thing. He did that thing that, I hate to say it, Thatcher did, make us want to be British again. And he Absolutely. Did it. He really drove it home and gave us a future. Is Keir Starmer doing that? I mean,
well, it hasn't yet. Absolutely not. And I think this is the problem with sometimes the way that politics is seen, is that you might look at Starmer and go, oh, well, he's a bit of a Blair because, you know, he's good looking and he's clever and he's got that kind of loyally thing going on. But where you're absolutely right is that Blair was onto something else. And actually, Blair showed this isn't that hard. Like, why the Labour Party is allergic to its own country's flag when at the last Labour conference they're all waving the Palestinian flag? I just think people think it's really, really odd. Most people have a fairly balanced view of where their country is, which is they really like it. It's their home. There's a lot to be proud of. And they want to think that the better days are yet to come. They don't think that everything we did in our history is appalling. They equally don't think that everything we did is great. They have a fairly balanced view. The empire was wrong. Intervening in World War II was right. The NHS is great. You know, it's not that hard. We want our football teams to do well. The St. George's Cross should not be a sign of far-right racism. The only way to stop it being is for progressive people to use it, not kind of be slightly snobby about it. And the same for the Union Jack. No one thinks that Scottish people are racist, and nor should they when they use the flag, nor the Welsh. So Labour doesn't just have a problem with Britishness. It has a specific problem with Englishness. And I just think a lot of people in politics, and obviously we're thinking about Labour at the moment because they're basically in a form of crisis, forget the fundamental thing, which is politics is about people. And if you don't understand people, you have no hope. And what motivates people? You know, this is about having basic human empathy. And that, to be fair, that's where Boris is good. I think he understands the instincts of people better than a lot of Labour people do. I still think he'd be beat by a really impressive Labour leader. But people are basically busy. They worry about their family. They worry about their work, paying the bills, paying the rent, paying the mortgage. They want to be able to have, you know, a holiday every now and again. They want to be able to go to the pub. They want to be able to do things that they like. And they want to, if they have children, leave something to them. They care about the NHS. They're not bothered about overtaxing the rich, but they don't want to see people living on the street. You know, there's a really, like, the fact that these statements of the obvious have not been articulated by the Labour Party sort of shows you how far they've you know, drifted. So all those things that you described, that being comfortable with your own nationhood and being comfortable with your own national identity, the vast majority of British people do not struggle with. They don't even think about it. It just comes naturally to them. It doesn't come naturally to the Labour Party. And a whole load of other things go with that. And that's why they basically don't know how to talk to us. And that is basically the root cause. And then you filter it through hard left politics and the trade unions and everything else. But the fundamental thing is, a lot of people in Labour actually don't understand the public at all. I mean, there are people in the Tories that you could say the same of that are completely antiquated on the other side. But that's the root cause of it. They don't really understand it.
When you see Jacob Rees-Mogg stand up in Parliament and start having a go at somebody else for what school he went to, you're like, oh, geez, really? Really? Are we still? I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg is hysterical. He's like, but he's very rich.
You know what? I had him on my podcast, and it's one of those things where it was really funny. It was very sweet. Obviously, it has a very distinctive way of speaking. You know, he's a kind of character, isn't he, really? Mm. And it's one of those classic things where you ask a question that you think, I wonder how he's going to answer this. And I said, oh, there's an old story about him campaigning at Falkirk in Scotland in a by-election. He took his nanny with him, leafleting. I said, is this true? And he went, yes, of course. I'm very close to Nanny and she wanted me to win. She's effectively part of the family. And he go, oh, yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. And it just kind of like, it sort of just pricked it. You know, I remember Tony Blair at Leveson when they were talking about Rebecca Brooks and the proximity to the media and one of the guys leading the questions. Is it true that you texted Rebecca Brooks on the day that she was arrested? Or something like that. I can't remember the thing. And Tony said, yeah, I did. You know, because, yeah, I'm not a fair weather friend. And you think, oh, actually, you actually made it sound almost like a good thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, just sometimes it's really easy to look at a situation and go, what are they playing at? And then when you hear the explanation, you go, oh, actually, yeah,
How did you learn to do the impressions?
Started doing them at school. You know what? I was obsessed with football immediately as a kid with Forest growing up in Nottingham. And I realised by about the age of 8 that I wasn't good enough really to ever play football. And that obviously is my first dream if you're a football fan. I was obsessed with commentary and the way football sounded. And particularly, you know, those booming voices like Motson. It's England against Scotland. It's at Wembley. We're joined by Tim Lovejoy, who was here on that day. You know, that kind of way of, and I love those big, you know, big sporting voices, the way sport sounds. Alan Hansen, all that. There's no way they're going to win it. And it just would do players a lot, and Pearce and Clough and people like that. And then just as I went through secondary school and started watching more of the news and stuff, then started doing politicians and William Hague and people like that. I tell you what's great is when you meet some of these people and then it almost helps you. It just pushes the impression along a little bit more. When I had Hague on the podcast, I'd never noticed this. And maybe he doesn't do it on telly, but he kind of hums in between other words. I said, well, I am faced Tony Blair many times over the dispatch box. It was just like a little verbal tick that I'd never got from telly before. It just sort of gave me that extra little touch on it. So I started impersonating them from a very young age. And then as the years have gone by, just added to the collection.
Can I request one? Can you do, you do your Noel Gallagher?
I love doing Noel Gallagher because, right, I don't know, right, what went on with our kid. Right. But I met Johnny Marr. It's the slight touch on the side of the face. It's the lean in. Right. I ask you. He's so good at, I mean, probably not since Clough has there been such a brilliant soundbite driven.
Aren't you a huge Oasis fan?
I'm obsessed with them.
So when Oasis and Tony Blair came together,
right, Forest are in the Premier League. In 1996, we got to the quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup, England at Wembley. Don't Look Back in Anger came out in 96. A year later, Blair gets elected. You just like, that was as good as my life ever got. You know, I was like, wow. And obviously at that time, you don't realise all this stuff is actually quite rare and it all happening at all is rare, let alone all together. And I think that's why so many of us reminisce about that time.
I've got a good question for you. Brian Clough, I keep saying he was the last, kind of one of the last gentleman managers left who actually understood the connection between the club and the and the fans, because he used to always tell the players, remember, I mean, he said some dodgy things in his time as well, but he said, remember, they're there, they've paid their money to come and see you. Now, I know as a Chelsea fan, my money is worthless because we've got a Russian who, wherever he got his money from, I don't know, he spends 300 million in a pandemic. You know, it's like, so my paying to get to go to Chelsea, any fan paying to go to Chelsea, you're not even paying for their hair gel anymore. You know, you're a customer now, and that's it. And it doesn't sit well with me. It really doesn't, right? Forrest, you're crap, so you're still important to the club. But what's weird is, like, when you got Gary Neville sitting there and he's going, I've said this a few times. I love Gary, by the way. I think his punditry is fantastic. When he's saying, oh, you know, with the ESL, it's not fair. It's like football's not been fair for a long time. It's also lost contact with the fans a long, long time ago. And we're still, the pundits have lost contact as well. They think we want to watch triangles being played. We actually want to see 11 versus 11 try and win a football and a football match. And I think they're missing the bit. I know you do a lot on football, but, you know, do you think that about Clough? He was really clever in the way he positioned Nottingham Forest Football Club, didn't he, with the fans?
Oh, yes. And if you talk to supporters of any club, Clough is the first thing they ask about. If you say you're Forest, any taxi driver in the world is like, Cloughy, that's all they want to talk about. And Clough transcended football, and it's easy to forget now. And I wasn't born when Forest were champions of Europe. I was born in 82, so missed the real, real glory. But I remember him managing us and getting us to Wembley and having Stuart Pearce and those great players. He transcended football, Clough. He was a genuine national mainstream TV star. He was like bigger than Piers Morgan is now. Like, he was just on telly all the time. Every demographic loved him. It wasn't just football fans. Old women loved him. They loved him when he was on Parkinson or Frost. He was like a national star. So people's connection to him was so profound because he was charismatic and because he understood, again, you know, this comes back to it. And he was a very political man himself, Clough. He understood people and he understood what people wanted. But, and football, what they wanted, as you said, was really attractive, successful football. And that's what he did at Forest. But he made them into entertainers.
What I liked about him also, he would hate the modern era of football because he said you have to have respect for the referee.
Yeah. Right?
Jose Mourinho, Sir Alex Ferguson, et cetera, all hammer the referee constantly. He said that you have to play the game fairly. Now, I remember I was banging on about this. Sorry, this is going to turn into a football podcast. We'll go back to something. but when Micah Richards and I can't remember who, Joe Cole or someone, were discussing Grealish going to Man United and sooner, and they said one of his skills is he can win fouls, or he wins fouls or something. And Graham Souness went, but that simulation and cheating, and they went, no, it's not. That's the thing. Cloughy would have hated that, right? I'm sure there's Forest players who have gone down, but he would have, you know, if he'd see, he, you know, that we are a long way from where Robbie Fowler, David Seaman took out,
yes,
Robbie Fowler, and he got up, went, no, even though they got the penalty, we're so far away from that now. It's ridiculous. The English players are actually better than our European counterparts at the diving. You know, we're incredible at that now. And Cloughy would have hated it like the fans do.
Yeah, he was really one of the last bastions to be openly against that sort of thing. And obviously he really prided, part of the Forest brand was attractive football, but it was fair. Took your shirt in, yeah, you know, short hair, clean fair. Shaven, please. Top button done up. And you absolutely don't argue with refs. And one of the things that I always, as a visual, is that 1991 FA Cup final, when Gascoigne really should have been sent, either one of those challenges would be a straight red and should yeah. have been. And he didn't yeah. even get one yellow because it was a cup final because he was Gazza. And I love Gazza, but still, he should have been sent off. And what's mad is he studs Gary Parker in the chest, like immediately. You know, people just get on with it. He crops Gary Charles on the edge of the box and shatters his own leg. None of the Forest players have a go at the ref. It's a horror tackle. It's two on the trot. None of them have a go at Gascoigne. Just really calm and they get on with it. Now, if they'd have complained, would he have got sent off? I don't know. But there's something so surreal, particularly when you watch it by today's standards. You're like, and also by the standards of the time and the standards that came before it, the 70s, which is basically like a cage fight after those football matches. Look, it's just so they don't get involved. It's surreal.
But what? Because I've been doing a football podcast. I'm not doing it anymore. I stopped it. We did the alphabet. And when we finished, I stopped it. That was the deal. But what I kept on saying about this, hate VAR, hate the fact there's no contact. Loved the Champions League final because the ref just ignored Chelsea and City, who were both trying to cheat and go down. He just ignored them. It was brilliant. So it was a great final in the end. But I think the pundits and the TV companies and the actual game doesn't realize what the fans want. We want to see competitive football. All right, you're on £250,000 a year. You get a knee injury. I'm sorry about your knee injury, but it kind of comes with the, we can't, you know, it's like saying to, if we want to protect them so much that no tackles anymore, which is where we're getting to, well, we've got there. And I think the fans want to see competitive football and just fair football. And it's gone. And like politics, they don't seem to understand what the fans really want.
Well, VAR is a really good example of that. And diving as well. And I hate the fact it's called simulation. And you know what? There have been like, this happened incrementally.
Yeah, I've said it. Yeah.
I remember when foreigners used to do it, in inverted commas, and everyone was outraged.
Yep.
All of our grandparents like, we're not doing it over here. And you know, as you say, Clough was vocal against it. And then just a little bit here, a little bit there. I actually think Ferguson was a huge part of that. Keane and Cantona were basically allowed off the leash.
Yeah, and then what you had is you had Michael Owen and people like that saying you have the right to go down, right to go down if you're touched. And nowadays, any form of contact, you know, I like Michael Richards, by the way, but any form of contact, he goes, yeah, well, it's a foul. He touched him. He goes, yeah, but not where he went down. You know, touched his shoulder. His legs went. Why is he holding his face? You know, it's like...
Yeah. Like and that. it looks ludicrous. It does. Looks so silly.
They're very delicate, these footballers. And I find the whole thing really laughable, but there you go. Right, Labour Party. Do you feel bad when you slag the Labour Party off now? Like Forest, you know, I don't have like an allegiance like a football team, but you did with Labour. It was a big part of your life. When you're telling me Labour don't stand for anything, which is kind of what you said, I think.
Or not for what I believed. I mean, they did stand for something. I just thought it was appalling.
Do you struggle with that then?
Did at first, because I joined it really young. I really got into politics at a very young age, and I'd been in the Labour Party for most of my life, and I'd worked for it, you know, and working in politics, you know, I realise I've, because of the things we've talked about, I wouldn't want people to misunderstand, working in politics is massively rewarding, and I really recommend it to people. I mean, there's no motivation like it. I fully understand, in a way, what people get out of going into like the priesthood or the army, because it's kind of a mixture of those two things. Like, you put yourself at the service of this thing that is meant to improve people's lives. And you have, particularly in politics, you have to be out there putting the case all the time, winning elections. And there's something really motivating about that. It really gets you out of bed in the morning if you believe in the overall thing. So when the Labour Party starts to move away, and particularly under Corbyn, I mean, and I think the election results show that the British public felt the same way. Really, that wasn't the Labour Party anymore. The Labour Party has always been, and this is where Corbyn and his supporters fundamentally misunderstood, the Labour Party has never really been massively, massively left-wing. It's when it's won, it's always been around the mainstream, and even by, you know, some of the idols of Labour history, people like Nye Bevan, who founded the NHS, and Clement Attlee, who founded the welfare state, were pro-Trident, were pro-nuclear deterrent, and they were deeply patriotic individuals. Now, that is an anathema to Corbynisters. They don't understand that. They think that is totally contradictory to be as left-wing as Nye Bevan, but be a patriot and want a nuclear deterrent. Obviously, around that time, it was particularly pertinent. You could argue about, you know, its usefulness now. But the point is that they misunderstood Labour history. So in the end, the Labour Party wasn't the Labour Party at all. It was the Labour Party name over the door. But what it became was something completely alien to the party. It didn't stand for anything that I joined for.
Are you voting Conservative now?
No, I've never voted Conservative in my life. And I don't think I ever will. I mean, who knows where politics ends up? Do you know what I mean? There were, you know, what had you the think Tory Party gone on a different route and Brexit not happened? I still don't think I could bring myself to do it.
What do you think of the word woke? Because that seems to be a real useful weapon for the right at the moment, doesn't it? And it seems to be a very anti-woke seems to be a popular vote.
You know what? I think people on both sides, I mean, it's just the new political correctness debate, isn't it? And what I always thought about political correctness was, the first thing is, I think you have to go through these things almost like a flow chart, is often the desire behind these things is entirely noble, is, for instance, let's stop using racist language. That is a good thing. So, yes, I agree. We need to, you know, it's where you go from there and how you deal with it and how you deal with people who disagree. And equally, those people who disagree, you have a right to question their intentions. You know, you look at this whole thing about taking the knee where people are talking about booing it. I think booing taking the knee is insane. And actually, given how well England have communicated why they do it, you can only conclude that the people who are doing it are deeply unreasonable at best. So the whole woke thing, I think people just need to not take the bait on it because there are some people out there that want a divisive, I hate that phrase as well, culture war. Actually, most people don't think, most people are fair-minded and they would be horrified that they'd ever offended anyone. They would want to call you what you wanted to be called, whatever it was. Most people would respect your right to identify as whatever it is you want to identify with. And they would engage with you, I think, in an open-hearted and open-minded way that would try and understand whatever your personal struggle was. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. We get bogged down or we get slightly provoked by some of the coverage. And I think you shouldn't lose sight of the fact when all these things are going on, the vast majority of people are really good. Not everyone always expresses themselves well, not everyone is aware of the right vocabulary at the right time. I think sometimes you have to be generous to people, perhaps you disagree with. But I think taking the knee is a really good example of how, actually, in the end, no one can be in any doubt why that team takes the knee.
I interviewed Harriet Harman on this podcast, and she was talking about women in the Labour Party. And there was a Blair got 100 female MPs, and sadly, the press called them Blair's babes. But the whole public and the press and everything were going, how are they going to do it? They've got to feed their babies and they've got to do this. And they worked it through. But that was kind of like the progression, which I suppose people are trying to constantly do. I think just the progression is getting more and more aggressive. If you don't agree with it, you're horrific rather than let's discuss it, don't you think?
Yes. Well, that's the real danger. And the real danger is that for some people, and I don't think this is most people, I just think it's for some, is that you end up taking a position to be the most woke person in the room.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and actually, if that's your starting point, rather than, oh, hang on, let me think about this issue in depth and where I stand on it. If you just go, well, I'm going to pick what I think is the most, say, woke option or enlightened or whatever, that's fine. But you're effectively sometimes then stuck in quite a sort of knee jerk. That by itself is quite a reactionary mindset because you're not necessarily engaging with every issue in the depth that it deserves. I mean, there's so many things. Think about the trans debate. I mean, I wouldn't really know where to start in trying to think that through. I think for a lot of people at the moment is a major task. But your starting point has to be that we're all going to go into this with open hearts and with fair minds and try and treat people as human beings is the fundamental thing. And I think at the moment, for so many reasons, there is a desire. And I think we always have to remind ourselves, this is a minority that want that row on both sides. You know, I think most people are just... Well, you must be fairly decent.
Yeah, you must have seen it. The world of politics has changed dramatically because of social media. And I think there's cracks in it now. I think hopefully companies, it's basically bosses and everybody else are starting to go, hold on a second, let's not take that shit seriously. But because they have for too long, like they've sacked people because there's a Twitter. Most people aren't bothering going onto Twitter to criticize people. You know for a fact when you do a TV show or something, you'll get people moan because they do. They like to do it. They've got a really easy way of doing it now because they can go straight onto Twitter and tell you what an arsehole you are. Do you know what I mean? You know, some of the criticisms I've had from doing my Sunday morning show are, I mean, unbloody believable what people want to moan about. It's just ridiculous. But you've got to be careful because if it builds momentum, then the bosses of Channel 4 have to go, oh, do we get rid of him? Now what they've got to do is say, sod this shit. We're not listening to Twitter. We'll make decisions, adult decisions, you know, if this guy's terrible for one thing he said, you know, it's ridiculous.
I totally agree. Is Twitter is basically the mob. And when I see brands or organizations kind of almost bullied on Twitter into taking decisions, that doesn't mean that every decision that's been taken there is wrong. But if you're doing it because you've been bullied on Twitter, you set such a dangerous precedent.
Yeah.
And it might feel like the quickest way to get it off your desk, stop the complaints. they're going to complain about the next guy and the next one and the next, and it'll be something else. And then you set a precedent then where you fire people for, you know, I mean, particularly if you think about Twitter, if you think about the way Twitter works, you know, people can set up multiple accounts. So actually, you only need to see what happens on Twitter, what happens in elections to know it is not actually a representative sample of British public opinion. And on top of that, it can appear so much bigger than it is. And I think that's a lesson for people who get abuse on social media, to remember that it's horrible and it's hard. Actually, a lot of the time, some of those accounts are the same person and they're well organized. And it's also a lesson for broadcasters and for organizations and charities and governments and everything. Anything that, you know, gets heat online is not that's not representative of public opinion on Twitter, let alone the country.
And, so. And the media who like to go, oh, Twitter said this today. It's like they've got, they're not going to stop doing that because they want the money, they want the clicks. Right, we're running out of time now and I still haven't decided who I'm voting for in the next general election.
Well, not that we haven't. That's the problem.
You're going to help me out with this. So listen, okay. Right, so I've gone onto their websites because I thought today I would have actually looked to see what their websites are appalling. I tell you, if you go back to work for Labour. Labour is basically, honestly, the whole of it is like, give us money, right from the first it's like, donate here, give us money. Yeah. Labour, honestly, Keir, if you're listening to this, I know you're not. You interviewed him recently, so you can tell me what he's like in 2 minutes. But Keir, you've got to stand for something, because all you're doing is saying, their website just says, this is Labour's history. Yeah, Labour's had an amazing history because it's got the NHS, right? There you go. It's got women, put women in parliament. It's fantastic. But what are you going to do for the future? They literally can't find anything. It's like, ours is a proud history with achievements from the NHS to the minimum wage. Yes, what are you going to do next, right? Then I go on to the Conservative one. We've got Brexit done so we can invest in our NHS scores and the police. We haven't got any money left, so we can't do any of that. They say we're going to unleash Britain's potential. The Conservatives offer a future, so they're talking about it after Brexit, where we move on to focus on our priorities, which are also your priorities: strengthening the NHS, investing in schools, a strong economy, safer streets, build back better. What the hell does build back better mean? They love a fucking catchphrase, don't they? The Tory, but take back control. Boris loves that. I've got three words to remember. What was he doing the other day? We're going to build back gender neutral or something. What was he talking about? It's incredible. And then our final one, Libs, Eb Davey says, what did he say? Ed will make sure that the Liberal Democrats are listening to and leading the fight for a fairer country. I've got to admit, I didn't know that the leader has changed for the Lib Dems. They have just fallen away to absolutely nothing, haven't they, really? But they're going to help us build a greener, fairer, more caring Britain. And if we want to join today, they all basically on their websites asked me to give them money, which I didn't do any of them. I did go on to the Greens as well, but I don't know. They're all similar. Who am I going to vote for, Matt?
Well, I think you have to think about which party best represents your values and what you believe in. I think it's also about the individual. I actually think the individual is a massive thing. It's who do you want to be prime minister? I think that's what it comes down to. Would you rather have Boris Johnson or Keir Starmer? And that in the end is...
But can Keir... you know this, right? You've seen behind the curtain in the Labour Party. You probably know behind the curtain in the Tory Party as well. Can he control the backbenches? Can he actually do stuff?
Well, this is the big question. And this is what we don't know yet. Is my advice to the Labour Party is... I think the danger is Labour leaders, if you think particularly Ed Miliband, and the danger for Keir is that he falls into this trap is, got to keep the Labour Party together, you know, party unity. I completely disagree. If you want to win a general election, there are people in that party you want to be seen to be getting rid of. And Neil Kinnock did it in 1985, where he takes on the militant tendency, a Labour council, that famous speech.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't win the election, but that moment made it possible for John Smith and then for Tony Blair to be in a position to win general elections. Tony Blair did it when he became leader. And he rewrote Clause 4. Now, the problem with that is people talk about a Clause 4 moment, and I think sometimes people listening might not know what that means. When Tony Blair became leader, it was literally enshrined effectively in the constitution of the Labour Party that they would renationalise all industry. And Labour had lost at that point 4 elections. And Tony Blair realised, if you want to make a big show that Labour under him was completely different, get rid of this sacred cow. So he had a vote in the Labour Party and said, we're changing the wording. we're dropping that pledge. He had a big conference, it led the news. Effectively, the news is the Labour Party has genuinely changed. Now, that involves winning hearts and minds in your own party and being prepared to lose people, being prepared that some will walk away, that they'll throw, you know, that they'll attack you. But you can't be basically living in fear of, you know, the attack dogs at the bottom of the garden, who, when they were in charge, Labour lost anyway. They're the people you need. You actually want those people to leave. They, if you get those people out of the Labour Party, running the Labour Party is easier and winning an election is easier. But I don't know whether Keir Starmer and the people running the Labour Party have the desire or the stamina to go on that journey.
My fury with politicians is this thing where they just want to slag each other off constantly. Have you? You must have been to PMQs, yeah? Have you been to?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, you're looking like you love it. When I had Harry and Harman on this podcast, and I think Alistair Campbell, I've said to them both, it's pathetic, honestly. These guys, we're paying, I know it's not a lot, we'll talk about it in a minute, but we're paying them money to stand there and just try and do real tin pot jokes at each other. It's you're laughing at it. It's pathetic. I want an adult conversation. When Jeremy Corbyn got leader of the Labour Party, I genuinely thought he might change it because he kept saying he was going to go in there. I mean, he just was inadequate, wasn't he, to take him on. But I watched Ed Miliband, the time I went, I watched Ed Miliband and he was... looks so nervous, shaking his papers around. And then in walked Cameron, like his chest out, and absolutely took it. It was like, took him apart. But it was just the... I just thought, this is ridiculous. Why can't we have an adult conversation? These are issues that are important to us. What do you think of that nonsense?
Well, I really like it for number one. I when it's good, it's phenomenal entertainment. It's one of the few bits of Parliament that the public watches. Yeah. So the rest of the week, Parliament is basically how you would want it to be. It is mature, reasoned contributions with... It pretty much is. You know, yeah. If you watch select committees, there's half an hour in the week where it's bedlam. And actually, I think it's important... And think of like our Democratic brothers and sisters. The American president doesn't have to face his opponents or her opponents week in, week out in this arena. You know, what better symbol that you live in a democracy that the Prime Minister is basically forced to attend the House of Commons and is jeered and barracked? Like, this is brilliant. He doesn't know what the Leader of the Opposition is going to ask him. I think it's great. You're like, this is democracy in action. Is you come here, you answer these questions, it's live on telly. I think it's fantastic.
I watch it regularly, but does it actually achieve anything?
Well, I think it gives the public a sense of who the leaders are. It shows them under pressure. It shows, you know, and if they've got the ability to be funny, it's a good stage to show your character off.
I don't want a comedian.
No, it's not just about being funny, but it's, you know, Blair was funny, but he was also very serious. Thatcher was funny, but also very serious. So, you know, it's just about, you get a sense of, you know what, it's the same as if you're writing a drama. And what is it they say? If you're writing any sort of script, put the characters under pressure early. Reveal who they are. See them in a moment of tension and it reveals. So I think it's a hugely revealing exercise to be able to turn on the telly every Wednesday and see what's Boris Johnson actually like and what's Keir Starmer like and what's their approach to power and to leadership.
I was just fascinated by watching Dennis Skinner the whole time. I just thought that was... we're overrunning here, but do you mind just going on for another...
No, not at all, as long as you need.
Couple of minutes, because I'm enjoying this. And when I watched Ed Miliband, I've just done it there, David Miliband. When I watched Ed Miliband, and I like Ed Miliband. I think he looks like a genuinely nice bloke, and he looks like his heart's in the right place for the country. He looks like one of those guys, but I did keep on thinking... Why isn't David Miliband standing there? Yeah. Miliband versus Cameron would have been brilliant, I just think.
Oh, it would have been great.
Definitely. Do you think they're paid enough, politicians? More so for the Tories, because I imagine a lot of these guys, like Cam, they come from these really like public schools. You know, I think the last tranche of them are even Theresa May and all that lot. They've all come from these lovely schools where their peers are earning millions a year. And they're taking this lowly job it's not lowly for us, but it's considered lowly. So you have to have huge financial backing like Jacob Rees-Mogg and stuff like that. Do you think it's about time we sort of put the wages up so we could attract people in especially on the Tory side, as I say?
Well, I think I would pay MPs more. I would also pay nurses more and NHS staff more. It's not just MPs in isolation. And obviously, compared to the national average, it's not a bad wage. But I think it's a really important job. And we send people there. The function of a Member of Parliament is twofold. It's to represent you in Parliament. And if you have an issue as a constituent, they, you know, effectively take it up on your behalf. They're also your representative in holding the government to account. And what that means is we've effectively organised ourselves as a society where the rest of us get on with our day jobs and work, and we elect someone to say, your job is to be the democracy person for this community. You go to Parliament during the week and you figure out what's going on and you vote according to your judgment. We're not going to bully you into it. And, you know, the idea that MPs are delegates is something I don't agree with, but you elect them for their judgment. We go, we like the look of you. You go there and you hold the government to account and all the rest of it. That's really important. The laws of the land are really important. Scrutinising the laws of the land, holding the government to account, forming a government and making the laws of the land are really important. And I think we don't really think about politicians in that way. And my experience of them in all parties is that they're not there for personal enrichment. There might be the odd one. The vast majority of people I've met in the Labour Party are not there for personal enrichment.
What about the Tories?
Yeah, not the same. No, I mean, again, I mean, in a way, in your question,
you say you really think Boris is there for the good of the people.
Well, I don't. Well, I think he's there because he is an egotist who wants to be prime minister for his ego. I think that's what drove him. He loved the idea of being able to, you know, hold the same office that Churchill held and feel big and powerful. I don't think he's necessarily that community minded. No. And I mean, as you say, a lot of them on the Tory benches kind of have to give up quite lucrative careers to go in. So most politicians are just trying to make the world a better place. Now, they disagree on what a better world is and how you get there. And that's the essence of politics then, is that your idea of a better world and mine may be vastly different. And that's what the House of Commons and democratic chambers are for. But the majority of them are sort of publicly minded individuals.
Okay, so I've got two more questions for you. First one, Keir Starmer, then. You interviewed him live. You did some live shows the other day. You interviewed him. Apologies, I haven't listened to that one as yet. What do you make of him?
I think he's a really decent bloke. And I think he's really, really sharp. And I think he's really talented. But, you know, for me and for people like me and for people like you, I think, we need to see which direction he's taking the Labour Party in. Now, a generous analysis of it is, he becomes leader and COVID hits, and it's very difficult during that period to hold the government to account and get on with the important business of taking on the Labour Party and moving that forward. But that's, as the Hartlepool by-election shows, that is now an urgent job. I mean, it always was an urgent job. So I think he's you know, he's a really fundamentally decent man. There are a few people you meet in life, I think, that really make that impression on you. And I can think of people that I met in local politics who were just like community spirits of people who ended up getting on the council. Just their whole life was just thought about how you improve it for other people. And I think Keir Starmer was one of those people.
I just hate
genuinely motivated.
I hate his stance on drugs. It's like he won't even entertain a conversation about it. Like all these ex-coppers and you know, people who work in drugs saying we've got to have drug prohibition. But as I said to Neil Woods on this podcast, who's runs UK Leap, Leap UK, is that if he sort of is pro legalizing drugs, it mucks up a lot of his career, where his legacy, because he spent a lot of time putting them in prison. But that shouldn't affect what he thinks about this, because, you know, it's a world issue, and we need him to entertain even a conversation about it. But he's really, no, I'm not getting involved in drugs are illegal. I just find that really big pig-headed, and that's one of the things where he could be forward thinking. The other thing the other question I wanted to ask you then is with, because you've seen behind, I get really frustrated with politicians when they say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, like Boris Johnson, and you think, well, all on your own, you haven't got anyone with you. No, why don't they use the language we? I'd feel a lot safer if Boris was saying we, and it wasn't an egomaniac, or Keir was saying, we are going to do this. Why don't they use that language? Is it because their egos, they want to say it's all them? Or do you think they believe the public like to think there's one guy doing the whole thing?
Well, that's a really good question. I think some of them do use we. I think once you're a party leader, you are putting yourself forward as the individual who run the country. And I know we don't live in a presidential system, but the leaders of the parties really are the single biggest effect on a party's polling and how they'll do in an election. So people have to get used to the idea that that individual is in charge. And I think, I imagine Keir Starmer probably does say we. I don't know. I mean, Boris obviously is just such a... Boris is like a rogue example, isn't he? Because he's so unusual in so many ways in his behaviour for a prime minister, for the leader of a mainstream party before this period. If you consider him to what went before him, you know, he's completely unusual.
Have the Tories got any talent coming through? Anyone who's different from these guys?
Oh, man. You know, the problem is Brexit has ruined the Tory party. Right. It has destroyed it because it effectively, they got, don't forget, the Tory party had a civil war, but it was only because the Labour Party's civil war was worse that they got away with it. If the Labour Party had been in any sort of sane, rational state, someone like David Miliband would have been leading it, the Tories would have been out by now. Because the infighting, you've got Dominic Cummings publishing texts to the Prime Minister. This is off the scale. It's gone so mad. We're just used to it now. You're like, this is not acceptable, right? So that's part of the reason. But yes, the talent on the Tory benches, if you look at Jeremy Hunt, super talented, would have been a brilliant leader of the Conservative Party. I tell you what, where's a really good place to look is who chairs select committees. So Tom Tugendhat is the chair of the, I think, the Foreign Affairs or the Defence Select Committee. He's Foreign Affairs. Absolutely brilliant. Would be a fantastic Foreign Secretary. Would be a great leader of the Tory party. Jeremy Hunt chairs the Health Select Committee. Would make, again, a really talented health spokesperson for the Tory party. There's some real, real talents on the Tory benches. But because of Brexit, they basically only recruit from one side of the party plus Matt Hancock. So it's basically just Brexiteers plus him. And like you're limiting the talent that you're going to bring through. And that's why you end up with Dominic Raab and Priti Patel and people like that in the government, because he's only recruiting from 50%, which is daft.
All right, finally, we are really out of a running now. It's supposed to be an hour long. We're already an hour and 10 minutes. Will you get into politics one day? Will you throw your hat in the ring?
Oh, absolutely not. No. No, it's for some of the reasons we discussed, really. I think, and I say this as a sign of respect to the people who go in, you need incredible resilience to go into politics. You need a level of drive for that particular pursuit that I don't possess. And I just think it's a, you know what? I mean, if I was going to go into politics at the moment, what would it be? Let's say it was the Labour Party. I can't be arsed arguing with people who are like going to let the Labour Party lose again. I'd just go, oh, fuck this. Not you lot again. I'd just be out of there. I just, you know what? If they can't get their own house in order, I just think, oh, God, you know, I can't be dealing with people who cannot accept basic facts. And I think in a way the public feel the same. I think the last few years have just been entirely repellent to so many voters. I think they've actually despaired at the state of British politics on both sides. So, no, I just think, oh, God, so much of it. You know what? You have to be so nice in politics to some fucking idiots. And I just couldn't. You know what? I interviewed one of the best interviews I've had on the podcast is Geisler Stewart, who was a Labour MP, German, was a big part of the Leave campaign and ran it with Boris. And she was like, in the end, in her last election campaign, they stopped her meeting the public because she would just tell them what they thought. She go, oh, don't be so stupid. What a silly thing to say. They're like, right. Keep her in the office, and she won the seat like against the odds. And she was like, it's because I wasn't allowed out. Accepted it.
I thought it was funny watching Biden the other day have a go at the journalist. It's like, because I think he just thought, I'm going to have an easy ride. I'm like, the American public love me. You know, after Trump, it's going to be horrific. Then they're asking him questions. He's like, you don't understand. You didn't do your job. I just thought, I feel sorry for politicians. It's a tough old gig, isn't it? Matt, it's been, I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mate, thank you so much for having me on. I hope it's been useful. I feel like I've just rambled a load of
rubbish. Do you know, it's a waste of an hour because I still don't know who I vote for.
But I don't either. So
you know what? If the parties should be looking at people like us, and I'm sure many of my listeners here, that I've got mates who are staunch Labour and staunch Tory, you know, and they would never change their votes. But people like me, they should be looking at us going, come on, if we can get another Tony Blair and another whoever in the Tory party, we could get these votes through, you know. So, yeah. You know, all right.
That's where the elections are won, you know.
But exactly right. Thank you so much for doing it today.
Mate, what a pleasure. It's been a real treat. Thank you.